Do you remember the morning the message showed up in there?
She asked.
Of course I do,
the secretary said.
Why did Mr. Stuyvesant leave his briefcase out here?
The secretary thought for a moment.
Because it was a Thursday.
What happens on a Thursday? Does he have an early meeting?
No. His wife goes to Baltimore Tuesdays and Thursdays. How is that connected? She volunteers at a hospital there.
Nagley looked straight at her.
How does that affect her husband's briefcase? She drives,
the secretary said.
She takes their car. They only have one. No department vehicle either, because Mr. Stuyvesant isn't operational anymore, so he has to come to work on the metro.
Nagley looked blank.
The subway?
The secretary nodded.
He has a special briefcase for Tuesdays and Thursdays, because he's forced to place it on the floor of the subway car. He won't do that with his regular briefcase because he thinks it gets dirty.
Nagley stood still. Reacher thought back to the videotapes, Stuyvesant leaving late on Wednesday evening, returning early on Thursday morning. I didn't notice a difference, he said. Looked like the same case to me. The secretary nodded in agreement.
They're identical items, she said. Same make, same vintage. He doesn't like for people to realize, but one is for his automobile and the other is for the subway car.
Why?
He hates dirt. I think he's afraid of it. Tuesdays and Thursdays, he won't take his subway car briefcase into his office at all. He leaves it out here all day, and I have to bring him things from it. If it's been raining, he leaves his shoes out here, too, like his office was a Japanese temple.
Nagley glanced at Reacher, made a face.
It's a harmless eccentricity,
the secretary said. Then she lowered her voice, as if she might be overheard all the way from the White House.
And absolutely unnecessary, in my opinion. The D.C. Metro is famous for being the cleanest subway in the world.
Okay, Nagley said, but weird.
It's harmless,
the secretary said again. Reacher lost interest and stepped behind her and looked at the fire door. It had a brushed steel push bar at waist height, like the city construction codes no doubt required it to have. He put his fingers on it, and it clicked back with silky precision. He pushed a little harder, and it folded up against the painted wood, and the door swung back. It was a heavy, fireproof item, and there were three large steel hinges carrying its weight. He stepped through to a small, square stairwell. There were concrete stairs, newer than the stone fabric of the building. They ran up to the higher floors and down towards street level. They had steel handrails. There were dim emergency lights behind glass in wire cages. Clearly, a narrow space had been appropriated in the back of the building during the modernization and dedicated to a full-bore fire escape system. There was a regular knob on the back of the door that operated the same latch as the push bar. It had a keyhole, but it wasn't locked. It turned easily. Makes sense, he thought. The building was secure as a whole. They didn't need for every floor to be isolated as well. He let the door close behind him and waited in the gloom on the stairwell for a second, turned the knob again, and reopened the door and stepped back into the brightness of the secretarial area, one pace, twisted, and looked up at the surveillance camera. It was right there above his head, set so it would pick him up sometime during his second step. He inched forward and let the door close behind him, checked the camera again. It would be seeing him by now, and he still had more than 8 feet to go before he reached Stuyvesant's door.
The cleaners put the message there, the secretary said. There's no other possible explanation.
Then her phone rang, and she excused herself politely and answered it. Reacher and Nagley walked back through the maze of corridors and found Froelich's office. It was quiet and dark and empty. Nagley flicked the halogen lights on and sat down at the desk. There was no other chair, so Reacher sat on the floor with his legs straight out and his back propped against the side of a file cabinet. "Tell me about the cleaners," he said. Nagley drummed a rhythm on the desk with her fingers. The click of her nails alternated with little papery thumps from the pads of her fingers.
"They're all lawyered up," she said. "The department sent them attorneys, one each. They're all Mirandized, too. Their human rights are fully protected. Wonderful, isn't it, the civilian world?"
Terrific. What did they say?
Nothing much. They clammed up tight, stubborn as hell, but worried as hell, too. They're looking at a rock and a hard place. Obviously, very frightened about revealing who told them to put the paper there, and equally frightened about losing their jobs and maybe going to jail. They can't win. It wasn't attractive.
You mentioned Stuyvesant's name?
Loud and clear. They know his name, obviously, but I'm not sure they know who he is, specifically. They're night workers. All they see is a bunch of offices. They don't see people. They didn't react to his name at all. They didn't really react to anything, just sat there, scared to death, looking at their lawyers, saying nothing.
You're slipping. People used to eat out of your hand, the way I recall it.
She nodded. I told you, I'm getting old. I couldn't get a handle on them anywhere. The lawyers wouldn't let me, really. The civilian justice system is very off-putting. I never felt so disconnected.
Reacher said nothing, checked his watch.
So what now?
Nagley asked. We wait, he said. The wait went slowly. Frohlich came back after an hour and a half and reported that Armstrong was safely back in his own office. She had persuaded him to come with her in the car. She told him she understood that he preferred to walk, but she made the point that her team needed operational fine-tuning, and there was no better time to do it than right now. She pushed it to the point where a refusal would have seemed like a prima donna pain in the ass, and Armstrong wasn't like that, so he climbed into the Suburban quite happily. The transfer through the tent at the Senate offices had worked without incident.
Now make some calls, Reacher said. See if anything's happened that we need to know about.
She checked with the D.C. cops first. There was the usual list of urban crimes and misdemeanors, but it would have been a stretch to categorize any of them as a demonstration of Armstrong's vulnerability. She transferred to the precinct holding the crazy guy and took a long verbal report on his status, hung up and shook her head.
Not connected, she said. They know him. IQ below 80, alcoholic, sleeps on the street, barely literate, and his prints don't match. He's got a record a yard long for jumping on anybody he's ever seen in the newspapers he sleeps under. Some kind of a bipolar problem. I suggest we forget all about him.
Okay, Reacher said. Then she opened up the National Crime Information Center database and looked at recent entries. They were flooding in from all over the country at a rate faster than one every second, faster than she could read them.
Hopeless, she said. We'll have to wait until midnight. Or 1 o'clock, Nagley said. It might happen on Central Time out there in Bismarck. They might shoot up his house or throw a rock through the window.
So Frohlich called the cops in Bismarck and asked for immediate notification of anything that could be even remotely connected to an interest in Armstrong. Then she made the same request to the North Dakota State Police and the FBI nationwide.
Maybe it won't happen, she said.
Reacher looked away. You better hope it does, he thought. Around 7 o'clock in the evening, the office complex began to quiet down. Most of the people visible in the corridors were drifting one way only, toward the front exit. They were wearing raincoats and carrying bags and briefcases.
Did you check out of the hotel?
Frohlich asked. Yes, Reacher said.
No, Nagley said. I make a terrible house guest.
Frohlich paused a beat, a little taken aback. But Reacher wasn't surprised. Nagley was a very solitary person, always had been. She kept herself to herself. He didn't know why.
Okay,
Frohlich said.
But we should take some time out, rest up and regroup later. I'll drop you guys off and then go try to get Armstrong home safely.
They rode together down to the garage, and Frohlich fired up her Suburban and drove Nagley to the hotel. Reacher walked with her as far as the bell captain's stand and reclaimed his Atlantic City clothes. They were packed with his old shoes and his toothbrush and his razor, folded up inside a black garbage bag he had taken from a maid's cart. It didn't impress the bellboy. But he carried it out to the Suburban anyway, and Reacher took it from him and gave him a dollar. Then he climbed back in alongside Frohlich, and she drove on. It was cold and dark and damp, and the traffic was bad. There was congestion everywhere. Long lines of red brake lights streamed ahead of them. Long lines of bright white headlights streamed toward them. They drove south across the 11th Street Bridge and fought through a maze of streets to Frohlich's house. She double-parked with the motor running and fiddled behind the steering wheel, and took her door key off its ring, handed it to him.
I'll be back in a couple of hours, she said.
Make yourself at home.
He took his bag and got out and watched her drive off. She made a right to loop back north over a different bridge and disappeared from sight. He crossed the sidewalk and unlocked her front door. The house was dark and warm. It had her perfume in it. He closed the door behind him and fumbled for a light switch. A low wattage bulb came on inside a yellow shade on a lamp on a small chest of drawers. It gave a soft, muted light. He put the key down next to it and dropped his bag at the foot of the stairs and stepped into the living room, switched on the light, walked on into the kitchen, looked around. There were basement stairs behind a door. He stood still for a second with his ritual curiosity nagging at him. It was an ingrained reflex, like breathing. But was it polite to search your host's house, just out of habit? Of course not. But he couldn't resist. He walked down the stairs, switching lights on as he went. The basement itself was a dark space walled with smooth old concrete. It had a furnace and a water softener in it, a washing machine and an electric dryer, shelving units, old suitcases, plenty of miscellaneous junk stacked all around, but nothing of any great significance. He walked back up, turned off the lights. Opposite the head of the stairs was an enclosed space right next to the kitchen. It was larger than a closet, smaller than a room, maybe a pantry, originally. It had been fitted out as a tiny home office. There was a rolling chair and a desk and shelves, all of them a few years old. They looked like chain store versions of real office furniture, with plenty of wear and tear on them. Maybe they were second hand. There was a computer, fairly old, an inkjet printer connected to it with a fat cable. He moved back into the kitchen. He looked at all the usual places women hide things in kitchens, and found $500 in mixed bills inside an earthenware casserole on a high shelf inside a cupboard. Emergency cash. Maybe an old Y2K precaution that she decided to stick with afterward. He found an M9 Beretta 9mm sidearm in a drawer, carefully hidden under a stack of placemats. It was old and scratched and stained with dried oil and random patches. Probably Army surplus, redistributed to another government department. Last generation Secret Service issue, without a doubt. It was unloaded. The magazine was missing. He opened the next drawer to the left and put his hand on four spares, laid out in a line under an oven glove. They were all loaded with standard jacketed cartridges. Good news and bad news. The layout was smart. Pick up the gun with your right hand, access the magazines with your left. Sound ergonomics. But storing magazines full of bullets was a bad idea. Leave them long enough, the spring in the magazine learns its compressed shape and won't function right. More jams are caused by tired magazine springs than any other single reason. Better to keep the gun with a single shell locked in the chamber and all the other bullets loose. You can fire once right-handed while you thumb loose shells into an empty magazine with your left. Slower than the ideal, but a lot better than pulling the trigger and hearing nothing at all except a dull click. He closed the kitchen drawers and moved back into the living room. Nothing there, except a hollowed-out book on the shelves, and it was empty. He turned on the TV, and it worked. He had once known a guy who hid things inside a gutted TV set. The guy's quarters had been searched 8 times before anybody thought to check that everything was exactly as it seemed. There was nothing in the hallway, nothing taped under the drawers in the little chest, nothing in the bathrooms, nothing of significance in the bedrooms, except a shoebox under Froelich's bed. It was full of letters addressed in Joe's handwriting. He put them back without reading them. Went back downstairs and carried his garbage bag up to the guest room. Decided to wait an hour and then eat alone if she wasn't back. He would send for the hot and sour and the General So's again. It had been pretty good. He put his bathroom items next to the sink, hung his Atlantic City clothes in the closet next to Joe's abandoned suits. He looked at them and stood still for a long moment, and then selected one at random and pulled it off the rail.